Here's the trailer to that film. The trailer to the film Dark Hobby.
This is marine wildlife. This is a Hawaii treasure. And they're stealing it. You need two things to be an aquarium collector in Hawaii. It's a pulse and $50. At any given moment, there are 27 million reef wildlife individuals in the aquarium pipeline. The pipeline begins at the point of capture, and it ends when the fish goes belly up in a home aquarium. The mortality rates are about 99% within a year of the point of capture. All those fish demand replacement, and the demand comes from the home hobbyist. That's how the system works.
Environmental, social, technological. Tonight, we'll be talking about a film that exposes the environmental and other devastation of the aquarium trade in Hawaii and around the world. The Dark Hobby is a beautiful and powerful film that will be released to the public this coming Saturday. We've had an opportunity to view it twice.
We'll shortly be talking with the producer, director, and co-author of the film, Paula Poos, and then with scientists and activists Jonathan Balcom and Gail Grabowski, who are interviewed in the film.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR listeners and by the COVID-conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets Wednesdays at the North Valley Plaza, Saturdays in Chico at 4th and Wall, plus weekly markets starting in Paradise in June. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, bringing food lovers and farmers together since 1980.
The opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll take a short break and talk with Paula Poos, producer, director, and co-author of The Dark Hobby. Ecotopia on KZFR, and we'll start off by saying that in the three short interviews we're going to do tonight, we won't be able to do justice to the film, The Dark Hobby, or the expertise of the people we'll be talking with. On the phone with us now is Paula Poos, who co-wrote, produced, and directed this film. She has numerous film credits and awards on topics ranging from historical gypsies to religious tolerance, and has authored a book on religious conflict. She is the president of Paradise Filmworks International. Welcome, Paula Poos.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so great to have you. We love the film. So thank you for letting us talk to you about it.
very, very happy that you love the film, and your radio show is just fantastic.
Well, tell us a little bit about, let's start with the title, The Dark Hobby. What's the film about? What does the title mean?
The film is about reef wildlife and how the aquarium trade has been decimating species and in turn hurting the reef and the ocean by the removal of fish for a very long time, or the removal of reef wildlife for collectors to sell them to be housed in aquariums. A lot of usually private aquariums all over the world, you know, that collectors have. And the Dark Hobby title itself is a title that Robert Wintner, who's a great reef activist based in Hawaii, it represents how collectors have done so much harm, which most of us never realize, but the way that the fish are removed, you know, their swim bladders are pierced with a needle, and their fins are trimmed with scissors, and it's just a very brutal situation, actually. So a play on words, I think, when you speak about the dark hobby. It's a hobby that people have because the fish are so lovely, they are so beautiful, and everyone wants a piece of nature in their own home, you know, which today you can actually get off a video screen. But yet the way that the fish have their own lives taken away and their own freedom, in the brutal way which they're caught and shipped to the mainland. So I think that's what he meant by the title, The Dark Hobby.
What are you trying to accomplish with this film, and who are the attendant viewers? What are the aims of this film?
The film is to raise awareness, and it's a global problem, what's happening with reef wildlife. Because all over the world, whether it be the Philippines, whether it be Thailand, there's many locations where fish are even caught for the aquarium trade, or reef wildlife are collected for the aquarium trade through the use of cyanide. And then those fish will become very jaundiced, and they'll have yellow eyes. Or by throwing dynamite, some of the fishermen will damage the coral very badly. They'll throw the dynamite into the ocean, the fish become stunned, and they float to the surface. So we are trying to let the public know and to gain their support with the kind of legislation and movement that has taken place in Hawaii because of what I like to refer to as the conservation heroes there. And they're represented and they're speaking themselves in the film, The Dark Hobby, about the many, many years that they have been spending, you know, over 10 years, fighting in courts and passing laws and just standing there and sticking up for, you know, reef wildlife that doesn't have a voice of its own.
Had you been aware of this issue before you started working on the film with Robert Wintner and others?
I never knew anything about it. I was very shocked to find out, you know, like everyone else, I love looking at fish.
Me too. I love
looking at beautiful colors and these unique species that exist. I understand that some of them have even become extinct already.
Wow.
We didn't know about it either until, I guess we got a press release from Robert Wintner now 7 or 8 years ago, and we had him on the show, and I've had him a couple times since then. So that's how we became enlightened, and we've become sincere opponents of not only the aquarium trade, but we have doubts about major aquaria like the one in San Francisco. Is this a good idea or not?
Well, we now know it's not. We now know how many millions of fish die from that, and it's kind of ruined it for me because I love that aquarium, but I can't anymore because you've been very successful in making this film raise consciousness and be very convincing about the damage that's being done. So how did you go about documenting this? Because it's a pretty wide-ranging film. And what are some of the worldwide sites that you go for your film clips?
Well, let's see. There is definitely Indonesia and Palau, and a lot of this unbelievable footage was shot by Keith Christie and Robert Wintner, and also Robert does phenomenal stills of the fish when they are diving underwater. Cuba, they've gone all over the world to many, many locations, and we were able to use the stunning footage that they have managed to collect. And then we also got footage from several other providers that normally in the making of a documentary film, you have to research and go, you know, to various companies.
Mm-hmm. You also had film, you mentioned earlier, the dynamiting of fish, spraying cyanide. There's a clip in there where there's a confrontation between an activist and a fish collector who attacks the activist. How did you come up with that kind of material?
Well, there were a few people there in Hawaii at the time that the diver, Renee Umberger, she was underwater, and she was documenting, at the time, collectors who were in the bay removing fish. They were gathering them into nets, and that's when she was attacked. So there were a few people who were able to supply us the footage of that particular occasion, which was really, really shocking to see.
Yes.
And it was covered a lot on the news, too. We saw a lot of television station footage from various TV stations in Hawaii that also were using basically the same footage that we did.
Right. You have some amazing people, talking heads on the film. Very convincing, very compassionate. Could you tell us a little bit about the spokespeople that you selected for this film?
Oh, absolutely. We have a wide range of really wonderful people. A few of them are plaintiffs, or they've been plaintiffs in the many lawsuits that have taken place to protect reef wildlife. And that is Willie Kaupiko, and he's the mayor of the village Milalihi, which is the last fishing village in Hawaii. It's on the Big Island.
Mm-hmm.
And his son, Kaimi Kaupiko, he's a cultural practitioner, and he teaches. He's a teacher, so he's very used to working with young people, and he's been involved in helping to save the virtual ways that Hawaiians have lived their lives, you know, before I think so much devastation has occurred to the islands, like the ways they would fish and, you know, just how you can fish and yet they protect at the same time. They just don't go, you know, limitlessly out there. And, of course, Gail Grabowski, she's an amazing marine biologist who teaches at Chaminade University. Jonathan Balcom, he is an ethologist and animal behaviorist and just exceptional author. They really speak for these fish. I mean, they really can actually put us into their heads in a way, I think. I never knew anything about so much about reef wildlife and that they feel. They make plans. They communicate. They even sing. And in the Dark Hobby film, we even use some of the singing that they do, which was recorded in Australia.
And I wanted to ask about Kamehameha Kapahulehua.
Kamehameha is a Hawaiian elder. He is a phenomenal, in many ways. He does paddling. He canoes all over. I mean, as far as he's done a circuit of the entire Hawaiian Islands, his uncle told him to canoe around them all as if,
yes,
you know, you're making a lay. Mm-hmm. And he's regarded as an elder or someone who has a great knowledge of their society and their cultural traditions and passes them on. And he really speaks, I think, for the ancient culture of Hawaii and their view about the land, about the ocean, about the reef, and its inhabitants. So he's able to bring that to the film, which is very, very special. None of us could, you know, understand the viewpoint of that. It's almost a spiritual sense that he brings to the film.
Yes, mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, I think you do a fabulous job of bringing that out as well. There's one of our fun clips. I don't know if it involves Kim Okeo, where somebody on the there's a group of Native Hawaiians out paddling an outrigger canoe, and somebody says from the shore, "Don't lean over to the side." And sure enough, they do, and over it goes. So I just wanted to ask, I had an opportunity to work a couple of years ago on a documentary film called Totem. It's about gun control with a colleague here in Chico.
Gun culture.
And just amazing the amount of work. I mean, little snippets of script all over the dining room table and long lists of things to use. How do you sort through all this and find your narrative for the film?
Well, luckily we had some wonderful editors working with us. Timothy Kettle, and he worked a lot with William Hogsey, who goes back as the person who, one of the people actually, who edited Hoop Dreams and was nominated for the Academy Award for doing that film. And they're able to pick up these strands of stories out of so much footage. Like, you can have hours and hours and hours of coverage. And we really had to weave together, you know, what looks sensational out of the stunning underwater footage that Robert Wintner and Keith Christie were able to put together. And yet you have, you know, you have news clips, because you're talking about things that most people find to be very boring, you know, like legislative meetings and that type of thing. So it's quite a weaving process. And then we have the most wonderful composer, who's Luciano Storti, and his music is just able to captivate and carry the viewers through this whole storyline that goes back and forth, you know, between political movement and then this stunning underwater world that Reef Wildlife lives in.
It's beautiful. The film ends with a piece of good news, and this is a spoiler alert, because you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's, you're really kind of on the edge of the seat. So what is the good news, and what is its significance?
The good news is that the Supreme Court had already, gosh, I guess it was about 3 years prior, actually, to 2021, they had already said that collecting reef wildlife in Hawaii is not legal. You know, it's not allowed, particularly with not with without having a ecological study first, environmental review,
right,
they call it.
Right.
And for some reason, this still was going on and on. So the circuit court reviewed it again, and they upheld this decision of the Supreme Court. That all of our heroes who are in the film have worked so hard to make this happen, you know, over 10 years. I'd say at least 11 years. On and on with the lawsuits and, you know, going to court. And it's just been a very long process. Earth Justice was involved. Teresa Telecki, the Humane Society of International Humane Society USA, and of course, all of our conservation heroes.
Wonderful. When and how will the film be released? It's released this Saturday, I think. And how can our viewers access it? Our listeners and all viewers out there in the world.
It is going to be streaming on iTunes, Vudu, YouTube, Vimeo, and Google Play so far. And more sites will be added, more platforms will be added. And you can go to The Dark Hobby on Facebook.com. And TheDarkHobby.com is the website. And all of the links are there to be able to stream the film.
Wonderful. Our granddaughter is working on a project on environmentalism in Half Moon Bay and California. And I really want her to see this film, so I'm going to get her to this.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Our guest has been Paula Faust. She is the writer, producer, and director of The Dark Hobby, which in some ways is devastatingly depressing, but also incredibly beautiful and with a happy ending, at least for the state of Hawaii. Thank you so much, Paula, for joining us on the show. We're going to take a short break now, and we will get to talk with Jonathan Balcom, the ethnologist and activist who knows what fish know and think. So thank you for...
Thank you, Paula.
Yeah, thank you for coming onto the show.
Thank you so much.
Our guest on the phone with us now is Jonathan Balcom. He's an ethnologist and activist who is one of the important people in the film. He's written a book called "What a Fish Knows," and he figures prominently in The Dark Hobby. Excuse me. He studied the behavior of many animals and insects, and as an activist, has worked with the Humane Society of the U.S. Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. So welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. We were fascinated by the film, and we are fascinated about what you had to say about what fish feel and know. Can you tell us more about feelings and perceptions and thoughts and planning and pain and pleasure and needs and everything about fish that make them seem not so different from us?
Sure. We've certainly underestimated them greatly. They do remarkable things, and I'm a synthesizer. When I wrote my book about fish, I looked at the research that other clever biologists had done, and they show that the fishes, for instance, get stressed the way we do when they're confined or captured, and they seek stress relief, and they love a massage, a caress. Being caressed really de-stresses them, just like it does us if we go to a massage parlor. They communicate in sophisticated ways. They recognize and know other individuals in their communities. There's a fish called a grouper on the reef that uses referential gestures. They shake their head to invite moray eels, a different species, to go foraging with them, and they do much better when they work together as a team. Fishes show virtue. They'll delay gratification to help another one who they hang out with when they're foraging. They show friendship, long-term relationships. They show tool use. They just do so many things that we never thought they could do. They're much more complex and intelligent than we thought.
I'd like to hear a little more about virtue. Could you explain how they demonstrate that?
Sure. So the example I like to give, and it's just one of many possibilities, is a reef fish called rabbit fishes. These are like so many of the fishes we see in The Dark Hobby film. They're beautiful, colorful creatures. And they often forage in pairs, and they feed on algae in the reef. And to feed on algae in the reef, you've got to get your head down there among the nooks and crannies. But the problem with that is you're not able to notice danger that may be approaching a shark or moray eel or a large grouper may be hungry. So wouldn't it be nice if you could have another fish playing lookout for you? And that's exactly what happens. The other one in the pair is not foraging. They're face up, looking out, and if they see trouble coming, they will signal and they will both escape as quickly as they can. And then, of course, the one who's playing lookout will switch with the one who's been feeding. So the other one looks out for the first one who was feeding. And so everybody gets fed much more safely. And it's an example of delayed gratification, because the one who's playing lookout, of course, is not getting any food. They have to wait their turn. So it's an example of virtue in fishing.
Mm-hmm. How do you avoid anthropomorphizing the fish? There's a tendency with our language to, when we see behavior like that, to make it sound more human than it is, when in fact it's the fish's own style of behavior.
Absolutely, an important question. You know, I try to tell it like it is, and scientists are very, very reluctant to anthropomorphize. They don't like to say, you know, that the animal is feeling exactly what we're feeling. How do we know exactly what they're feeling? So what we do is we observe behavior, and we give them different challenges in different situations, and we see how they respond to those. So when we let a fish who's stressed have the opportunity to get caressed by a cleaner wrasse, in fact, it was a model of a cleaner wrasse hooked up to a motor, you know, we're not telling the fish what to do. We're not demonstrating for them. We know their stress. We can measure their cortisol levels in their blood. And you give those stressed fish a chance to go and get caressed, and they go up next to that moving model and they get caressed. They did that to an average of, I think it was 15 times per hour. Fishes who in the control group who were also stressed, but their cleaner fish model didn't move. It couldn't give them caresses. They ignored it. Zero visits per hour. So a very marked difference. And of course, the scientists measured the blood during these experiments and found that the ones who were getting stressed, their cortisol levels, their blood stress levels came down rapidly back to baseline, whereas the other ones, their stress levels remained high. This is so, it is reminiscent of what we might expect in humans. And it doesn't tell us exactly how they're feeling, but it fits with the assumption, with the sense that these are animals who have inner lives, they have experiences, they can feel not just physical pain and pleasure, but also psychological pain and pleasure, and they will take action to improve their situation if you give them the chance.
So you called yourself a synthesizer. Have you been able to do your own sort of documentation? Have you been able to do experiments or... And the other question that I have that's related to that is, how much of the research that's been done on fish is laboratory research doing studies with fish, and how much is observation of being with the fish in their natural environment?
Sure. Well, to answer the first question first, you know, I haven't done experiments per se on fishes, but I've spent quite a lot of time swimming among them. Not quite so much now that I live in Ontario, Canada, but during the I was living in Florida, and I would go snorkeling in the ocean at least twice a week. And it was really great to be able to read studies and synthesize those studies as I was working on the book, and then go and swim and see the kind of behaviors that I've been reading about. Seeing the community, the fact that fishes have their own shoal mates they like to hang out with, and they feel safer in their own kind. The fact that it's not just willy-nilly, it's not just a bunch of fish swimming around at random. They're in particular groups. And then things like attachment. Once I had a little tiny fish who just followed me everywhere. I actually felt guilty when I got out of the ocean because I had to leave this fish behind. It just shows they're individuals with thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And are there good fish and bad fish? I mean, are there some fish that are,
good question.
You know, a naughty tribe, and then there's good tribes? And do you see variations in the kind of either ethical behavior or pleasure behavior or any of those categories that you have taken us into?
We certainly know that fishes have personalities, that different individuals have different ways of responding to things. Little guppies, if they're afraid, some of them may flee, some of them may freeze. Other ones might even try and threaten or swim close to the predator as if to say, I know you're there, I can get away, don't even try and catch me. As to whether there are good and bad individuals, I would hazard a guess. I don't know if anyone's actually studied that, but I would hazard a guess that in a community of individuals, because you have different personalities, you may have some who are more badass than others, for instance. So you're probably going to find variation in that. Scientists have only recently started to ask these sorts of questions, which are important to ask.
Could you give us a sense of the dark hobby reviews what happens to aquarium fish from the time they're caught on the reef, bagged up and sent abroad? Could you review for us what you think some of the feelings and other emotions that the fish experience when that happens?
Sure. We certainly know fishes can feel fear. Some fishes actually have a fear chemical that they release when they're afraid, and other fishes detect that and they know it's there. So it's probably very scary for them to be caught. If the collectors are using poisons or explosives, as is documented in the film, that's probably terrifying and, of course, lethal, unfortunately, for some fishes. They don't recover from these traumas. And then if there is some depth, being raised to the surface rapidly can cause decompression, which can cause the swim bladder to expand, which can crush neighboring organs and can cause often lethal injury. So that's the capture situation. And then captivity, they're wrapped into these plastic bags. They've never been in that situation before. So the visual and the water pressure situation is totally different. And then they're jostled around, often in the dark. They may be put in boxes. They may be flown. They may be shipped. I can only imagine how stressful that is, given that the studies show that just being caught and taken out of the water briefly is very stressful to a fish. No wonder that, as is pointed out in the film, some 90% are dead by the time they get to their destination, and another 90% are dead a year later after being in a home tank.
Do you have thoughts, by the way, about sports fishing and catch and release? And those clearly, those inflict trauma on fish as well.
I have opinions about that. I fished briefly when I was a kid, and I stopped because I didn't like what I saw. I felt even sorry for the worms on the hooks, writhing on the hooks. But I mean, the fish is getting hooked out of the water. It's a terrible stress for them to be suffocating. They don't die quickly, and studies show that that just being caught, the stress of being brought to the boat side, and then if they're released. Many of them die. That's been studied by monitoring individuals who've been released. As for those who say that, well, I've caught a fish many times in the same day, or the fish already has hooks in his mouth, well, the fish has got to eat. The fish is probably very hungry, and if you were told that there might be something sharp in every tenth salad you ate, would you stop eating salads? Maybe you'd eat them more carefully, but you'd still have to eat, so... pick your food and try to relate, put ourselves in their situation a little bit, show a little compassion, I think is something we ought to do.
So what should we do legally about all of these kinds of things, but particularly the aquarium trade? Should it be, should our goal be to try to abolish it altogether? And should we then just plan not to have aquaria? One of my favorite places has always been the Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. The aquarium is incredibly beautiful. But this film has just made me doubt all of my pleasure and interest.
Yeah, there's no question that fishes are beautiful. And I've been in an aquarium for a media interview a couple of years ago, the one in Toronto. However, with the technology we have today and the cinematography techniques we have, we can have virtual aquaria. You can actually have your big screen TV at home showing scenes, including online streaming scenes from actual ocean reefs and other habitats. Surely that's a much better way than to have these poor animals in captivity. I'm definitely opposed to plundering wild fish communities so that people can have the survivors in their tanks for a while. I think we need to move away from that model, and we need to be respectful of the fish. By all means, watch them, but either go swim in their habitat to watch them or take films. And, it's sort of like on land, take nothing but pictures, leave nothing but footprints. We should do the same in the oceans and let them stay there and instead watch beautiful pictures of them or live or recorded on our televisions at home.
Mm.
I saw on your website that you've got a new book, or I guess it's out, Superfly, about insect intelligence. I want to have a read of that. I have to say, though, I just went on, I Googled it, and I came up with a book that appears to be the autobiography of a stripper. This was not the book that you wrote. How can I get a copy of Superfly?
Well, I think I haven't seen the cover of that other one, but I think when you see the cover of my book, you'll
I can tell the difference.
That.
Yes,
the book about the stripper.
Good observation. Yeah,
but that book is officially coming out a week from today.
Oh, wow!
Okay, good.
At all bookstores online around the world, pretty much. So, you'll have an easy time finding it. But give me another call if you're having any trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
This, I think, is relevant because it broadens the sense, the whole field for us of animal sentience. It's not just the fish. We'd want to protect the aquarium fish, but there are flies out there in my kitchen who have feelings.
Yeah. There was a famous Buddhist monk, and I can't remember his name or even his era, but he used to have people go ahead of him and sweep the insects away in front of him so that he wouldn't accidentally kill anything. I would think that you might suffer a little bit from your sensitivity to creatures.
Well, it is challenging in a way, but it's also, you know, my sensitivity is also matched by my curiosity. And I think of animals as my clients, and they do so much for me. Just learning about their lives, observing them, you know, writing and researching this book about fish and the book about flies was an absolute joy. It's a lot of work, you know, 1,000 hours of work or so, but it's so many rewards, and they constantly surprise me with what they're capable of doing. And I'm really glad that we're talking about other groups of animals that used to be just glossed over. Mm-hmm. We can't do that anymore. We need them to survive on this planet more than they need us.
Thank you so much. We loved the film. We appreciated everything that you had to say. Our guest has been Jonathan Balcom. We'll put information about Superfly on our website as well. And we're looking forward to that. And thank you so much for the work that you've done with fish and for heightening our consciousness and our consciences to the world of fish.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks for the conversation. I really enjoyed it.
I did, too. Thank you.
We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Gail Grabowski, who's Director of Environmental Studies at Chaminade University in Honolulu. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we're previewing an amazing film that will be coming out Saturday. The Dark Hobby documents the damage being done to tropical fish through harvesting to the coral reefs, the reefs that support those fish, and that they in turn support. It's a symbiotic relationship. Our guest is now Gail Grabowski. She's the director of the Environmental Studies Program at Chaminade University in Honolulu. She has been active in the campaign to ban the aquarium trade. Welcome, Gail Grabowski.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We really loved the film, really felt educated by the film, and we've learned a lot, so thank you for doing the work on that. On the film, you explore the relationship between the fish and the reefs, as well as the threats to both. Can you explain that relationship?
Yes, between the fish and the coral reef, yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. Please.
So, just to start kind of small, is most of the fish that are collected off the reef for the aquaria, and some people call it collection and some people call it trafficking, that's how strongly some people feel about it. Most of the fish that we do take off the reef are herbivorous, meaning that they basically eat salads, right? They're the fish that eat the algae, or limu as we call it here in Hawaii. And the reason is that it's hard to have a little predator in your tank, yeah, with other fish. So there are some that are not herbivorous. There are some that are omnivorous, and you'll have to have special food for them. But the majority eat algae. And the connection with the reef is that when a reef has a lot of algae on it, so one of the ways that happens is when there's no herbivores or when there's few herbivores. When there's a lot of algae, the coral doesn't do well, because when the coral reproduces and the little tiny coral planula, they're called, settle on the reef, when they look for a place to land after they've been floating in the water for a while and grow into a coral head, they look for a spot that isn't covered with large macroalgae. They sense it chemically, yeah? So what happens is if we remove all the fish from the reef that eat the algae, then one, the algae grows over the coral and shades it out. And since coral, as probably most of your listeners know, they're animals, but they kind of live like plants because they have little tiny single-cell algae that live in their tissues. If they get shaded out by algae, then they die. And so if we have algae growing all over them and algae growing all over the places that the new colonies would start, we end up with what's called a phase shift to a reef that's all algae. And so the herbivores are super important, and fish are most of them. Sea urchins are also important, but the fish are really the more abundant, in most places, herbivores. So we're basically allowing the coral to get smothered and to have no place for new colonies to grow. So that's kind of just the real specific on the aquarium fish. But, you know, in general, whenever we tinker with an ecosystem, I know all of us have in our head this image of a food chain, you know, from one fish eats another fish. But out there, it really, especially on a reef or a tropical rainforest, is a food web. So it's super complicated. Who eats who? So we're tinkering with the abundances of all these different fish, and we are just changing the dynamics that are happening on the reef. And this is just to talk about the fish, you guys. This isn't even to talk about climate change,
right,
and runoff pollution, which are also huge threats to coral reefs, or to talk about the pressure they're under for food fishing. So I think, hope that answered that. The most important thing is that we're removing fish that are really needed to help create a home for coral.
I was going to ask that question that you just referred to about the other impacts of on the reefs, because we've heard a lot about reefs getting too hot, about them dying out for various reasons. What are some of the other, how is climate change a threat to reefs, for example?
Sure. I think we'd say, for in terms of the oceans and climate change effects, the two that are like most directly related to the reef is the warming of the water, and as the water absorbs carbon dioxide, right, one of the major three greenhouse gases, it becomes more acidic. And when it becomes more acidic, then it's harder for all the critters that make their skeletons out of basically chalk, calcium carbonate, limestone, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. They have a harder time precipitating their skeletons in that chemical environment. So the causes are the greenhouse gases, yeah, and the consequences that really affect the reef are the warming water, which causes the coral, especially if the warming lasts over a period of time, causes them to lose or throw out those little algae that live in them. Mm. And that's when they turn really white, and everybody calls that. And it's a good name, except my students always think that it's called bleaching because it's bleach. But no, it's called bleaching because all the little colorful algae called zooxanthellae, see, it's a great science word, yeah?
Which really means
little algae that lives inside an animal. They get thrown out of the coral when the water's warm, or they leave. Yeah, there's a lot of really neat research investigating why exactly does it bleach, but it bleaches when the water's warm. So we're really pressuring the coral in so many ways now, and climate change related, we're making it harder for them to make their skeletons, which means less protection from storms, and it means less habitat for all these amazing coral reef critters. And we're also warming the water so that they can't feed themselves, because when they lose their algae, the algae makes sugar for them. That's what plants do, yeah? They make sugar by photosynthesis. So the coral starves. Now, sometimes they can recover, but a lot of times they don't, and you end up going from a bleached white reef to a dead reef covered with algae. I know it's sad. There's one thing about this. It's sad. Mm-hmm. But there are fixes.
Good. I want to hear about that.
About
Good.
Well, first of all, what is the state of the reefs in Hawaii right now? I've read some things, and it didn't sound good to me. Are there efforts to protect them or to help restore them? And what is the good news?
Yeah, it's a good question. If you look at the international data, our reefs in Hawaii, and it really matters where you're looking. If you're looking at the populated islands like Oahu, yeah, then our reefs are not doing super well. If you look at us related internationally, there are places that are doing way worse, just so you know that. So there are places, particularly in the Caribbean, that are just really, really devastated. So even our worst reefs are better than some of the reefs around the Pacific and in other oceans. But we could be doing so much better. Now, there's some silver linings and wonderful things happening. Some of the real wonderful things happening are Papahanaumokuakea National Marine Monument, which you guys may know, north of Niihau. We have one of the largest marine protected areas in the world. Most people don't realize that the Hawaiian Islands really go up another 1,200 kilometers, all the way up to Kure. And so that whole area is protected from any type of extraction. Now, there are some alien species up there, but otherwise it's had a few bleaching, but it's in good shape. But down in the main Hawaiian Islands, we have overfished, first of all. So for food, which I say is a need, yeah, I mean, people eat reef fish all over the world, and that is a super important part of culture and tradition. And so the aquarium collection is really a want. Yeah,
we've
removed fish, and we do have some bleaching, but the thing we could really do better in Hawaii is establish more either community managed areas. We have some of those places where Hawaiian communities, in particular, are doing management in the way that they know how and they're good at it. And also, we could probably do what the world recommends. It's very hard to get done though because it's hard to find agreement. But the conservation data says we should protect 30% of the reef everywhere to have spillover, meaning healthy spots that then feed the other areas. And we, on Oahu, we have less than 1% fully protected.
Oh, wow.
Although our State Department of Land Natural Research Resources is holding meetings for what they call 30 by 30. So they're trying to find, to get some consensus on where could we protect. You can imagine how challenging it is to pick areas where people can't extract in a place like Hawaii, yeah.
You mentioned in the film concern about the people who are currently doing the harvesting, and we know that we've got some bad people doing it, and we're not talking about the people at the top of that food chain, which would be the international distributors, but there are a lot of locals, people in poverty who depend on capturing the reef fish for the aquarium trade. And you addressed that. What are your thoughts about balancing the damage done to the local cultural economy versus protecting the reefs and the reef fish?
Sure, it's such a good question, and I think over time, the sort of direness of climate change has changed a lot of people's feelings about it because, initially, way back when, I'm so old, I remember Jacques Cousteau, you know, the oceans are infinite. Well, we know that's not true anymore, and that we can have impacts, and so there's been, you know, there's studies showing impacts. There are some areas that have protected smaller sub areas that are doing better, but we don't seem to be mustering on the protection. So I have switched my message. In the early days, I would say, I'm sorry, we just don't have, you know, we don't have people that are blacksmiths like we used to, or candle makers. So this is a job that needs to stop, but that doesn't work very well. That was before I, you know, was much deeper in my thinking of, I don't know what to say, sort of collective common good. Mm-hmm. And so what we can do is aquaculture. So maybe for the past 10 years, I've been thinking and saying, and other people, why don't we just, give grants and all types of research incentives for fish aquaculture? We do it in freshwater, and they've already figured out the clownfish. There's an app called Tank Watch that you can use to see whether the fish you're buying is aquacultured, because most people don't realize most of the fish are coming from the reef. So if we grow them, you know, basically we're farming them like we do so much food fish today, then we could have fish in our tanks that didn't come off the reef. Isn't that just a great thing? And fish spawn. It's not a problem getting them to spawn. Raising the larvae is what takes some figuring out what they like to eat. But, you know, a yellow tang spawns a whole bunch of eggs and egg and sperm, and there's a ton of larvae, and we are super close. Some people have already figured it out. We're not sort of scaling that up yet. But isn't that the perfect answer?
Yes.
So we could have fish on the reef and fish in tanks, so that then people who have the tank would want to go to the reef to see where there were still fish.
There's so much optimism in the way that you talk. I love it. So what do you see as the future for both of these things, to preserve the reefs and the fish, and to supply people with the opportunity to see fish? What is your level of optimism?
Yes, okay. I've been teaching a long time, and I've been pulling my students on that last question, our optimism. I'm always glad that they are optimistic, because this whole issue has taught me how long it takes to make change.
Yes.
And I think I'm a scientist by training, so much of my argument is often scientific, like, you know, showing that I did a study where we can see that on Oahu there are 90% more of the most collected fish inside Hanauma Bay than outside. So where you'd have 100 fish in Hanauma Bay, you have 10 outside in an equal area. So I always thought the science would motivate. But, you know, lately, for me, it's come down to be just as important to make the moral argument.
Yes.
You know, the future generations, the fact that we know removing fish impacts the health of the coral reef. So if we do an economic type argument, there's a new paper out about the value of the reef for storm protection, and Waikiki's reef turns out to be worth $74.8 million in storm surge protection. And so we want that reef healthy. So to me, the scientific argument and the moral argument about this is a want and not a need, and we have a replacement potential, you know, whole new revenue stream in aquaculture, and then the fact that the reef has great value for ecotourism, for food fish, for protection, you know, for in its own right, you know, as something. You could even go religious on it and say, look, we were put here to look after creation. Yeah. You know, I'm at this Catholic university, and we think about that a lot. Let's care for creation, whether you're Christian or not. Let's care for this amazing place we live in. And the Hawaiians will make a beautiful argument about the future generations, you know, because they'll look back and forward and say the reef fish to them sometimes represent very sacred things, and that the loss would just be much bigger than losing the ability to have a fish in a tank.
We want to thank you, Gail Grabowski, for being with us on Ecotopia tonight. Listeners, Gail is featured prominently in the film. You can learn a lot more from her, and we suspect that she's a great teacher, as well as being... She is an administrator at Chaminade. We don't know about that based on our experience, but thank you for being with us tonight. We really appreciate what you do on behalf of the fish.
Oh, and thank you for what you guys are doing. It's been a joy.
Thank you.
Sure, be well.
Mm-hmm. You too. Thank Bye-bye. You.
Tonight on Ecotopia, we've been talking about the dark hobby, both the film and the hobby of keeping aquarium fish. We've certainly been persuaded about the harm being done by aquarium suppliers and, let's face it, by well-meaning hobbyists.
We love the film. We think you will, too. It will be released on Saturday and will be streaming on iTunes, Apple TV, YouTube, and other platforms. And you can learn more and even host a screening at darkhobby.com. You go ahead, Steve. You thank them.
We want to thank Gail Faust, Jonathan Balcom, Gail Grabowski for talking with us tonight. And we want to express our longstanding appreciation to Robert Wintner, a.k.a. Snorkel Bob, who first taught us about the damage being done by the aquarium trade. This is Ecotopia on KZFR.
Coming up at 6, it's Bobby Tryon with North State Give and Take. She'll be talking with activist Charles Withune of the newly formed North State Shelter Team, working on showers and parking for the homeless.
So thank you for listening to Ecotopia. We're available on the web at ecotopiakzfr.com. You can always get in touch with us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. Just stay tuned to KZFR. Coming up in a moment or two, it's Bobby Tryon, North State Give and Take, which we've already announced. Great, we're going to announce it again. We're busy as beavers up here. Bobby Tryon in 17 seconds.
You're tuned to 90.1 FM KZFR Chico. Up next is North State Give and Take, and it's made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers, located in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase.